Brian Noonan in for Nick. Nick will be back tomorrow night. He's just taking the night off because it's the Oscars. That's Nick's Super Bowl. So, of course, he's taking the night off to revel in all the awards. And I am happy to be here. It's always good to be in for Nick. And I get to talk to people that I've had the pleasure of talking to before. One of them is Rod Pyle. He is an author. He is a space expert. Some of his books include Innovation, the NASA Way, and Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who make it happen. Rod, thank you so much for being with me this morning. I appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you. A lot of big space stories. Let's start with the Scott Kelly story. He has been in space for almost a year. He's finally coming home this week, and it was a he gave an interview the other day. They were asking about his physical well-being. How will Scott be after spending that much time in space?
Well, you know, zero G is not a great place for the human body. This is something they've struggled with for a long time. It was noticed early on in the space program, particularly when the Russians started doing longer missions. And then we've had a number of long-duration missions, this, of course, being the longest continuous number of days for an American astronaut. So you'll notice if you saw him on the video, if you look at the pictures, his face has gotten rounder as he's been up there.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. But, yeah, so the fluid, you know, when you're on Earth, you're under 1G of gravity all the time, 1 Earth gravity. So it's always pulling all the fluids in your body, the water and the lymphatic fluids and the blood down towards the bottom. And your body is used to that. It equalizes and makes it all work. And when you get into space, suddenly all bets are off because there's no gravity, right?
Right.
So all these liquids kind of start drifting up towards the center of your body mass. And as the astronauts describe it, it's like having a permanent head cold. And you get used to it after a while. So that begins to happen. And then because the gravity isn't pulling against your bones and making your body work as you walk around, you start losing calcium through urine and so forth, and your bones begin to get brittle and weaker. And there's a bunch of other stuff. The weirdest one, I think, is the eyes change shape over time.
Well, how is it a liquid thing? How does that happen?
I was talking to a flight surgeon at Johnson Space Center about 2 years ago, and he said, we're not really sure what the exact mechanism is, but they tend to elongate, and they don't always come back. Sometimes over time they do, sometimes they don't. So vision does change, and in some cases can stay that way. And I thought, you know, it's not huge. I mean, it's not like they're blind or something. It's just a change in focus, but it's got to be compensated for. So the longer you're up there, the more this stuff happens. And they do hours of exercise a day on these treadmills that they're strapped to and so forth to try and compensate for this, but it's tough on the body. So you see after these long duration missions, these guys come home in that little tiny Soyuz capsule where they're sitting shoulder to shoulder, and when they come out, it's right onto the stretchers, the gurneys, because they're as weak as kittens.
Now, I know NASA and Russia, everybody's been studying this. How long will it take him to get quote-unquote back to normal after being up there for 340 days? Is there an estimate on that?
Well, he was in really good shape, as all these guys are,
sure.
But he's kind of a physical specimen. So a matter of months, I think, he'll be up and around within a few days, but a matter of months for the kind of large-scale stuff, and then the smaller things taper off longer over time. Like I said, some things don't come back right away, and they do have increased radiation exposure and so forth, although it's small. But it can take quite a while. The great thing in this mission, of course, is he's got this twin brother who was also an astronaut, Mark Kelly, down here on Earth. So they've got this perfectly matched genetic pair that they can compare when Scott gets back and say, okay, let's look at these two guys. All things being equal, you were in space, you weren't. Let's see what exactly changed. So that's the first time that's happened, and that's really cool.
That is cool. Now, other than looking at Scott Kelly and trying to figure out, okay, how long can we keep astronauts in space for longer missions, maybe a Mars down the road or something like that, what other kind of things are they looking to learn from a mission of this length?
Well, I think that's the main thing. I mean, there's so many dynamics to going out to Mars. You've got the zero-G problem. You've got this huge radiation problem because the sun throws off tons of energy, and there's stuff coming in from outside the solar system. So they've got that to deal with, not the space station because it's still within the magnetic shield that the Earth creates for the most part. But that's another one. How the body treats food, how the body treats water, fluids of the body, all this kind of stuff. So much of this is for longer duration missions like going to Mars. Or even looking at what happens, extrapolating from this for small gravity as opposed to no gravity, because if you're on the moon, say we end up going back to the moon, which mm-hmm. is always under discussion, that's about 1/6 Earth gravity. If you go to Mars, that's about 40% of Earth gravity. So you may not be just looking at 0G, you're also looking at less than 1G and the effects of that, and that's something that they've got to figure out. So there's a whole suite of things that they're studying when they look at this.
You brought up the moon. What's the holdup of going back, and what would be the benefit of going back? Did we not learn as much as we could when we've been up there in the past?
No, we really didn't. I mean, all the missions were equatorial because that was the easiest place, the safest place to go. Different kinds of terrain, but all basically, you know, within a number of degrees of the equator. So the northern and southern regions haven't really been studied. We didn't make any landings on the far side because that would put it in radio silence from Earth, and they didn't want that. So, you know, it's kind of like studying the Earth by going to 6 or 7 different locations and saying, okay, we understand the whole planet. Obviously, okay. It's not as dynamic as the Earth, but there's still a lot to know. One thing that they're really interested in finding out more about is up on the North and South Poles, where it's in shadow all the time. They think there may be big reserves of water ice up there, and where you've got water ice off Earth, you have what you need to make rocket fuel and air to breathe and water to drink and all this stuff. So that's one thing that they're really keen on finding, probably robotically at first, but eventually that's something they might want to actually go up and mine and use.
Now, we were talking about Mars, going to Mars, and real quick before we go to break, and we can touch on this a little more after if you want, NASA is trying to develop a new propulsion system that could get people to Mars or light crafts to Mars in as little as 72 hours. This is some sort of, you could explain it better than I can, some sort of photonic propulsion system?
Yeah, it's a huge, huge laser array that you'd put up in orbit around the Earth or somewhere within that area and shoot this laser out. And then there's, in effect, what is a big solar sail or a sail that's attached to the spacecraft. The photons hit that and propel it from Earth. The advantage is you're not carrying your fuel with you, and so you've got a lot less mass that you're dragging along, and you've got this constant acceleration all the way out there. Now, when you talk about those fast flight times, you're talking about something really small, the size of a shoebox.
Okay.
If it's something more like a spacecraft, say the size of a shuttle or something, it's more in the matter of an order of a month or so. But it's still way better than what we've got now,
right?
Because you're leaving the fuel behind at home, and it's generating all the power from there. That's fantastic if you can make it work, but it's a big project.
Well, how would you – that's fine for getting there, but would you be able to use the same laser to get you back?
There's a couple of different schemes that involve bouncing the light back and forth and so forth, but it would be difficult. You'd either have to build something else up at Mars or make the mission out there the primary objective. And there's been a lot of talk about that, too, about, you know, one-way trips where you send robots up first and they set up a base station and actually print your buildings and so forth and drill for water and create breathable oxygen, all that sort of thing. And then you go up there, and the basic idea is to stay with runs home, basically something of an emergency nature. So you're actually putting up, in effect, what becomes moves from a base to a colony over time.
Would it be feasible to send Matt Damon up there? He already has experience.
Well, he's old enough, and he's responsible enough. I think he could probably do the training, so why not? You know,
All right.
We need some really fine-looking astronauts up there, and he's kind of a specimen.
Yeah, let's get the start populating Mars with some attractive people. Rod Pyle is my guest. PyleBooks.com is the website. You can pick up all of Rod's books, including Innovation, the NASA Way, and Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who make it happen. We've got to talk about a lot of different things. SpaceX, they had another mishap today, and a lot of other stuff with Rod. We'll do that on the other side. If you can hang on, Rod, we'll talk to you on the other side of the news. Let's do this, then it will be news time on 720 WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Nick coming back tomorrow. For tonight, we are talking space. Rod Pyle is my guest. PyleBooks.com is the website where you can pick up all Rod's books, including Innovation, the NASA Way, and Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who made it happen. Rod, again, thanks for taking time this morning. Always good to talk to you. Let's go back for a minute. Why is it just money that is keeping the space program from developing, from NASA going forward?
No, I mean, that's a big part of it. At the height of Apollo, we were spending almost 5% of the budget on the space program. Now we're spending a half of 1%. And also, it's important to remember that back then, basically everything for manned space was going in to get to the moon, and what little was left over for robotics was going to Mars and Mercury and Venus. That was kind of it. So there's a handful of missions.
Right.
Now, not only are they operating on this much smaller amount of money, but they've got the Voyagers having recently left the solar system. They've got stuff all over and around Mars. They've got all kinds of Earth orbiting satellites. And then we've got the space station to pay for, which is not inexpensive. So there's a ton, you know, literally dozens and dozens of missions that NASA's tracking and operating at any given time. So that's expensive. So to do new stuff on top of that is a continuing challenge. There's also political factors. You know, every time a new president comes in, as we saw with Obama, for better or worse, he looked at the moon program that George Bush had suggested in 2004 and said, nah, that's going to be too expensive. We're not going to do that. Been to the moon. Let's go to an asteroid. That's been kind of unpopular, depending on who you talk to.
Right.
So we're still planning to do it. But whether we'll actually finish that or not, nobody really knows. We just know that we have this kind of overarching idea of we want to go to Mars. Do we go to the moon on the way back or not? Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah, I think it's good. All right, for the uninitiated, people may have heard of SpaceX. They may not know what's going on. There were supposed to be, as of Sunday, there were supposed to be three launches this week. None of them happened. Can you explain to the uninitiated what SpaceX is and why it's different than other programs, and what happened this week that three launches got scrubbed?
SpaceX is the invention of Elon Musk, who made his money originally on PayPal and a couple of other ventures. So he started SpaceX as a company to build rockets and supply launch services to the government, and at one point talking about sending tourists up into orbit like some of the other companies are trying to do.
Right.
But basically it's a launch services company. So with the Air Force and NASA said, I'm going to build rockets to launch your stuff. And they said, that's nice, kid. You're out. And they, you know, kind of metaphorically patted him on the head, sent him out the door, which, of course, you do that to Elon Musk. It's like, oh, you made a mistake. I'll show you.
Right.
So he came back within 10 years. He's launching rockets, and he's got a contract with NASA to supply the space station with cargo, and in about a year and a half with the flying astronauts up there instead of the Russians, who are buying rides now for, I think it's $75 million per ride up there. So it's a private company that he started. Very unorthodox in that he put in about $110, $120 million up front of his own money. And when you're talking about Boeing and Lockheed and those companies, you know, they spend some money on development, but mainly it's, okay, government, give us money, we'll build your rocket.
Uh-huh.
And they're having a little trouble changing that model. Musk said, I'll design, build, and test this thing myself. All you got to do is buy the rides.
That sounds like a good deal.
It is a good deal. And his main accomplishment at this point, besides having pulled this off, is he's made the first stage of this rocket reusable. So as you've seen, there have been attempts, one successful, to fly it back and land it.
Right.
And eventually refurbish it and reuse it, which could ultimately bring launch costs down somewhere between an order of a tenth to maybe even more inexpensive. So that instead of spending $50 to $80 million per launch to get cargo up there, you're spending more like $10 to $15 million, which is huge. We've been talking about this for years. You can make it cheaper. You could do a lot more. We can make it less expensive to lug all the stuff up there that we need to make these missions happen. Mars will happen a lot faster. And that's his ultimate goal. Just because he wants to, not necessarily a sound business decision, he says. He wants to colonize Mars. He'd love to go.
Now, are these the kind of rockets that potentially could be big enough to take, you know, manned spacecraft up? Or are these just basically cargo rockets? Is that what he's envisioning?
No, it's been designed to take up a spacecraft with humans in them, and that's what the Dragon capsule was originally designed for. They've now gone to a version 2, which is bigger and beautiful. I got to stick my head in one about a year ago, and it felt like the flight deck of the shuttle. It was a big, open space. Instead of all the hoses and tubes and boxes and stuff that you would have seen in a spacecraft in the 60s, it basically was a big shell with a few electronic cabinets and this beautiful glass computer display that flips down in front of the astronauts in the top row of seats. So it's a really brand new approach to how to build it, even though it looks like an older capsule design. It's a brand new approach to doing that. So he's at this point basically looking at two families of rockets. He's got the Falcon 9, which is the one that we see trying to launch this week, and then he's got the Falcon Heavy, which he's getting ready to test in the next few months to a year, I think, which is three Falcon 9 strapped together to make this big rocket. It's not as big as the super booster that NASA's building, but it's heading that direction. And if he can keep these costs down and bring these things back and use them again, it'll just be a serious game changer.
So what happened this week with the three scrubbed launches?
Well, you know, SpaceX has had a really good record. They had one explosion and some other smaller failures, but overall they've done really well. But the space business is tough. And at some point, I think, most of us thought, you know, you've done great, and most of that's because of your engineering and your expertise, and you're a hard charger and all that. But at some point, this is going to come around and nibble on your hindside, because that's just what happens. It's happened to NASA, it's happened to the Russians, it's happened to anybody who's been in this game. So what we saw this week was a couple of technical launch scrubs. The second one was because of a fuel valve, pressurizing valve, that didn't close properly. I don't remember what it was in the first one, but it was small.
Okay.
Today was so frustrating. They were ready to go. Everything looked good. And then some bozo drove a boat into the safe area, which is the water east of the Cape where they're launching.
Right.
Got to have an area for the rocket to fall down in case it doesn't make it. And if there's a boat there, they have to hold everything. So they waited for that for half an hour. Finally, they've got a few minutes left to go. They pushed the go button, and in the last second, as the ignition sequence started before it was supposed to take off, something in the computers on board said, "I have a problem," and shut it down. So you saw it flicker to life for a second, and then it shut off. Could be a fuel valve problem. It could be electronics. Could be a lot of things. So they're still working that. And I don't know when they're rescheduling for. Last I looked, they hadn't made a decision yet, but they were so close.
Well, and these are not, as you said, these are relatively small glitches today. Who knows what the computer issue was, but these aren't the kind of things that are going to derail an entire program. It's just something that, all right, we go in, we make this tweak, and then I know that with three this week, that was a relatively short turnaround. You say now there's no schedule. Is there ever a time to, can you, or does it, from problem to problem, how long it's going to take to fix?
Well, there's two things. One is there's launch windows that can range anywhere from minutes to hours, which is the time span in which you can get the rocket where you want it to be. So sometimes they're just a couple minutes long. I think today's was 3 or 4 hours.
And so what determines those windows, Rod?
Orbital dynamics, where your target is, because if you're launching as a space station, you've got to figure out where it is, where it's going to be, where you aim to get there, all that kind of stuff. Then there's weather to worry about. And, you know, if they want to make a landing during day or night, they think about that. And, of course, for them, it's not just launch weather conditions, but they also need to take into account, if they can, good weather to try and get the thing back, because it flies back under rocket power. So there's a whole bunch of stuff they have to look at. I suspect it'll be within the next number of days, because you don't want to – if you leave the rocket out there too long, you now have to drag it back into the protected building and really completely safe it, whereas at this point they've just drained the fuel out and made sure everything's okay. So I suspect in the next day or two we'll see them trying again.
So why are they making it so it can land on either – we used to see everything land in the water. Now they can land on barges. They can land on dry land. What's the – is that just so they're more versatile?
That's an interesting question, and I called them to ask because I had seen so many different answers. And the answer is, if you're lofting a heavy payload, you may have to use almost all your fuel just to get that up into space, and you may not have enough to fly back at all, or you may not have enough to fly back the launch site. So flying back, because they're just bringing back the first stage, which doesn't go all the way into orbit, but still, it's got to have enough gas to slow down and fly back to the landing site, so, to the launch site. So if it flies back to the launch pad, that's about a 30 to 35% penalty, and that's about a third of your fuel load, so that's a bunch of weight that you can't carry up, right?
Okay, right.
If you fly back to the barge, it's only about 15%, because that's way downrange. So that's closer to where the rocket ends up overhead, so it's a much shorter distance to come back, and it takes less fuel. So that's why they're still working on these barge landings, because if you just look at it from the outside, you're thinking, why are you punishing yourself? you know, these barge landings, that some of the flights they've done, they've had 10-foot swells, so this thing's going up and down, the rocket's coming down, and if it happens to catch the barge while it's going down, that's okay. If it catches on the way up, that's not so good. And we've seen a number of times now this thing land and get so close, slowly it tips over and kabang. So it's an ongoing project. But the fact that they can even find the barge and get there, this thing's flying by itself. It's not being joysticked by anybody.
Okay.
It's doing the thinking. It's doing the flying. It says, I know where the barge is. I've got the signal. I got to put on the brakes now, and ooh, I've touched down. So there's a lot of stuff for it to do, and it's just amazing that they can pull this off at all.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, just to get that close would seem to be, like, I would say, hey, look it, we're a success. We hit the barge.
Right.
We didn't stay on it, but we hit it. That's pretty good.
I'd feel pretty successful if I could just get a rocket more than 2 feet long off the ground.
Yeah, how about, I remember my brother building little rockets, you know, out in the backyard. He could barely get them over the fence. So if you can send one up into space and it comes down and hits a barge, listen, you get a champagne bottle from me. That's pretty cool. Rod Pyle is my guest. Pylebooks.com is his website. You can pick up any number of his books, including Innovation, The NASA Way, and Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who made it happen. Rod, if you can hang out, we got to talk about this music coming off the moon. I don't know if there's somebody left a tape recorder up there, the radio on. I don't know what's going on up there. And there's a new documentary. And listen, we have to protect ourselves, the Earth, I mean, from everything that's out there. There might be a new program on that. So a lot to talk to. Rod Pyle's my guest. We'll have more with Rod in just a minute here on 720 WGN. Could this be the mysterious moon music? I don't know. I've never heard it before. It could be coming from outer space. It's Brian Noonan in for Nick, talking with Rod Pyle. He is a expert on space. Of course, he is, because he is an author who's written a number of books about space. Pylebooks.com is where you can find all of those. So we've got this new, recently declassified information. Some media is reporting, Rod, that there was mysterious moon music during the Apollo flights. I don't know if they were listening to, I don't know, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I don't know what they were listening to. Is this true? Where did it come from? What's going on with music in space?
Excellent question. Yeah, this has really made the rounds. It became kind of a big deal. This is a show on the Science Channel called NASA's Unexplained Files.
Ooh.
Yeah, you want to hear the echoplex on that one. And if you ever worked in reality TV, you know that when they say things like recently declassified, there's air quotes around it in everybody's mind, because you know, it's a lot of young producers scrambling to try and get something sensational on the air, and the networks like that. I worked this area for a while. And so the show basically said, we found this recently declassified material, and it shows that during Apollo 10 and some of the other flights, when they were on the far side of the moon, which is where you don't get any radio signals from Earth, they heard this mysterious music. And
wow.
They take a little sample of it and a transcript, the astronauts, Gene Cernan and Tom Stafford, run that mission saying, wow, that's weird. What is it? Do you think we ought to tell them? Maybe not.
No, they wouldn't believe us.
Well, when you cut it that way, it sounds really incriminating. But first up, this isn't recently declassified. I saw the transcripts of this back in the 80s and 90s just by going to the National Archives.
Yeah, but you're special. The rest of us don't get to see that kind of stuff, do we?
Well, I'm probably not special the way you're thinking. Anybody can go. The thing is that it's just recently been put on the web because NASA does this as it can. They don't have a big education budget. So over the years, they'll scan material and they'll post it on the web and they'll load up audio files and so forth. So if you really knew where to look, you'd find this, but it was recently posted.
Okay.
Not recently declassified. So what we're talking about is this weird kind of woo, woo sort of sound they're hearing. You work in radio. I used to have a shortwave set. You know, if you just start scanning frequencies, you hear all kinds of weird stuff out
right
there. Well, the Apollo spacecraft, so you had two spacecraft on this mission. You had the command module, which is the capsule, and the lunar module. They've both got radios. Then they've got redundant backup radios. They've got a transmitter that's sending down electronic signals so that mission control can watch the health of the spacecraft. They've got a voice channel. They've got biomedical telemetry coming down. They've got all kinds of heavy electronics, some shielded, some not, on these spacecraft, because remember, this is the 60s, so we were just moving away from vacuum tubes at that point. These are very early transistors. So any length of wire with a radio frequency going through it basically became an antenna or a transmitter. So there's all kinds of stuff flying around, all kinds of RF flying around up there. And when you get a couple of signals in adjacent frequencies, as I'm sure you know, you get, I think it's called a beat frequency.
Yeah, I think so.
They start to overlap and interfere, yeah. So as near as able to tell by trying to recreate this in the lab, that's basically what we're getting, were these overlapping, interfering frequencies of radio. And when you hear, if you've listened to the clip, it is this kind of sort of sound. It's really clearly interference. It's not, now, if it was coming from a galaxy or something, that would be great, and I'd be the first to say, we finally found them. Come on down, have us for lunch, whatever you're going to do. We're just happy we know there's life out there. But that's not what it was. You know, this was a fairly low accuracy receiver on this spacecraft, and they wouldn't be hearing things that far away unless they were right around the block. So that's the short version of the story.
All right, so it's no, they weren't hearing songs. They were just hearing radio frequencies. And I'm a little shocked, not by the story about the music, but the story that reality TV may not be as real as we think it is.
It's kind of stunning. It really sticks in your craw, doesn't it?
I'm disillusioned, Rod. I'm not going to lie to you. I held reality TV in the highest esteem, and now, well, you know, whatever. I'll live with the disappointment. But you mentioned that if we had heard, you know, signals from another galaxy, you would invite the alien, our alien masters down to have us for lunch or have lunch with us. Well, the government and NASA are finally putting up some money. It's theoretically to stop asteroids, but we know it's also going to stop the alien hordes from invading us. What's going on with this new Earth defense system?
This is very, very timely. This is the Planetary Defense Coordination Office. And the idea is there's a lot of stuff traveling around in space, most of it left over from the early formation of the solar system. So chunks of rocks, chunks of ice, comets, asteroids, you name it. And some of them come by the Earth in these repeating orbits, and some of them enter the Earth's atmosphere. There's stuff entering all the time. Mostly it's the size of a pea or maybe a golf ball, and they burn up. And that's why we see shooting stars, as they're called. Okay. They're these little objects burning up when they hit the atmosphere, and the friction causes them to incinerate. However, when they get bigger, that's a bad thing. So like that one that came in over Russia a couple of years ago, I think it was 60 feet, you know, that was the size of an atomic explosion. It was way high up, but what's spooky about that is it hadn't been spotted, so it caught us by surprise. And back in the bad old days of the Cold War, something like that could be mistaken by a satellite for a nuclear launch and a nuclear missile launch, and now you've got problems. So we try to keep an eye on these things. So over the last 5 years, the government finally said, okay, we got to take this seriously. So they've increased the budget by about 10 times for this, 5 to 10 times, excuse me. And they're spending a serious amount of money now starting to try and find what's out there. So they've found most of the big ones, and we're talking 3,000-foot, wide beasts, so, but the ones that are 500 and below, they've only found, they think, about 25 or 30% of them. So they need to have more telescopes on the ground and more instruments up in space looking to try and find these so they can predict the trajectory, know when it's coming. And then, of course, the big question is if we see a city killer or a county killer or a state killer coming in terms of size, mm-hmm. which would be respectively 200, 400, or 1,000 feet roughly in diameter, can we stop it? And so there's also plans of discussion and a lot of calculations being done about how you would do that. Do you use a rocket to deflect it? Do you use a nuclear explosion to try and shatter it? More likely, you'd try and use the nuclear explosion offside to deflect it away. Because if you can catch these things far enough out, a very small deflection means that it will miss Earth. But okay. If you see it at the last minute, that's bad.
Yeah, then you got to send Bruce Willis up with a lot of people, and they go moon crazy, don't they? They go crazy up there on the asteroid.
Yeah, you saw that too. Huh?
Sure, why not? That's as close as I'm going to come to being on an asteroid is to go up there. And I know we you talked earlier about money and all the different missions that NASA is currently watching. Is there ever a chance or any talk about bringing the shuttle program back? And what would if they did or is there any reason to, I guess, would be the other question.
No, at this point, the shuttle's gone for good. They've been decommissioned, sent off to museums. The assembly lines that were making the parts for them, like the external tank and so forth, which was an expendable item, are at this point either shut down or repurposed for other things. And the shuttle was kind of an expensive project that was so compromised by the time the Nixon administration got done trimming around the edges, it was so compromised. It was a wonderful, successful spacecraft and that it flew 135 missions and did that well with only a couple of mishaps, but it was not a cheap way to get to space.
Okay.
So at this point, the money, rather than continuing to invest the shuttle, the money is going towards the Orion capsule, which is that oversized, half again as big Apollo-style capsule they're making, but with completely new technologies, and a rocket called the Space Launch System, which is a Saturn V-class large booster. So although it looks like we're going back to 60s designs, the technology is all contemporary, and that rocket's going to get us where we want to go. We just have to pay for it.
All right. Well, let's hope we can find some money somewhere. Rod, it is always good to talk to you. People need to go to your site, pilebooks.com, pick up any number of your books, and find out all about space. As I said, it is always fascinating talking to you. I appreciate the time this morning.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Talk to you later. Take care. That's Rod Pyle. Pylebooks.com, again, is the website. Innovation, the NASA way, curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission, and the people who make it happen. Just some of Rod's books, so go pick those up. All right. Soon it will be news time, but first we must do this on WGN.